Case in Cure of a Deserted Soul by Joseph Simmons. Part 14, Chapter 29. Two other directions on how to restore communion with God. Plead with Christ and set your hands to work. Third, go to Christ and beg of him to cause a spirit of life to come into you. Put yourself upon Christ, but take heed of mistakes here. Number one. Think not that there is a greater willingness in Christ than in the Father or in the Holy Spirit to show mercy to you. You must honor the Son as you honor the Father, John 5, verse 23. They must have the same honor, for they are one. They have the same being, the same will, and the same thoughts. I and my Father are one, John 10, verse 30. They have the same friends. All thine are mine, and mine are thine, John 17, verse 10. Number two, think not that what you have from Christ, you have from him exclusively, for they are one fountain, and as they are one in nature, so they are one in all that mercy which is shown to us. Therefore, cast honor upon Christ in such a way that you also honor the Father and the Spirit. All that Christ does as mediator, he does by commission, and therefore he says that he comes to do the will of his Father, Hebrews 10, verse 7, John 6, verse 38. Look then upon this great mediator as one sealed of the Father and filled with the Spirit, yea, and clothed with our nature, standing between God and us to make both one and to convey to us all the riches of his Father. As the Son of God, he is equal with the Father and has a natural and eternal sovereignty with the Father. But as mediator, his power is economical, dispensed and delegated to him. All power is given to me, both in things in heaven and in things on earth. Matthew 28, verse 20. Therefore, lift up your heads with joy and come to Christ. Pray for him to look upon a poor beggar. He has much power in his hand. He is the Lord of life. Say, Lord, I need much. You have called me to buy gold, raiment, and eye salve from you. Now behold my poverty, nakedness, and blindness, and pity me. Revelation 3, verse 18. Say to him, Lord, I would rather bear all evils than this evil. I could think myself happy if I might enjoy you, though all other troubles were upon me. Lord, you know what it is for a soul to be forsaken, for it was sometimes your own case, as when you cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? O my Lord, unless you had divine support, it seems you did not have that inward joy which at other times did fill you. Now you are in your glory. Pity a worm in misery that mourns and desires more after you than in all things. Lord, you paid dearly for my good. Let good come unto me. I desire more from you, for you. Not merely that I might have more happiness, but that you might have better service. If you will give me much, I will return much. You have bid me, if my enemy hungers, to feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink. Romans 12, verse 20, Proverbs 25, verse 21. Lord, do not deny such mercies to your children. Though I have sinned, yet you are my Father, and though you should have been angry, yet am I not your child. This shall be your glory when these dead and dry bones shall live, when the grave shall be opened and the bonds of death shall be loosed, and I shall walk before you. You said to the woman of Samaria that if she had known the gift of God and yourself, she would have asked of you, and you would have given her living water. John 4, verse 10. Now, Lord, I know you and this gift. Those waters would be sweet unto my thirsting heart. Oh, give unto me also. I remember your former mercies, and my heart both joys and dies. The remembrance of these sweetnesses delights me, but the thought of their absence afflicts me. I could not have desired your presence except by you. These desires are yours. Do not turn them back without their fulfillment. I was well without you, or so I thought, until you came to me, And since your coming, I fell asleep again and was at rest. But you have called me, and now, Lord, what will you do for me? A little will do me good, and I will bless you. There's no sorrow equal to this, to have your face hidden from me, and lusts and devils to break in. Lord, what and how many are the troubles of my soul? Oh, in the multitude of your compassions, help me. I'm surrounded by a multitude of evils. Are you not set for the rising of them that fall, and to be a repairer of breaches? Is not your name Jesus, and is not salvation your employment? Oh, be a savior to me and pull my soul out of the depths. Remember your covenant. Thus take up words and courage and go to the throne of grace. Carry your empty sacks to your brother Joseph, for he is Lord of all Egypt. Stand not wasting yourself and sad thoughts of your misery, but arise and pray. Turn the streams of your grief toward Christ. He will turn them into streams of joy. Sit not like Hagar weeping in the desert for her child that is ready to die for thirst. Is the well not before you? Christ is the fountain. Let down your bucket, drink, and live. Go with indictments against yourself in one hand, and with Christ's promise and your petition in the other, and you will be heard. If you will take this course, then say, you proud lusts and troops of hell, you must pack and be gone. You clouds of darkness and unbelief must be scattered. You chains of death must get you hence. There is no abiding for you, for here the King of Glory will make his temple, his throne, and his rest. Come with your whole heart. Cold prayers and remissness of spirit lost what you seek, but fervent prayers will find again what you lost. Do not be discouraged, for here is the gate of life. He that dwells here is never away from home, nor ever asleep. Extend your prayers and stay till the alms come. The thing is sure, only the time is in the Lord's hand. Many times prayer is lost because you do not wait for the answer. Lie at the gate. You need not fear to knock, for the Lord will not be angry. You may be urgent. Rest the door open by strong prayers. It is not shut because you should not enter, but because you should knock. Ask leave to enter. The bars of the gate are mercy, and your prayers are like explosives that break away into the city. Therefore, turn your fears into hopes, your complaints into prayers, and your lamentation into supplication, and Christ will turn your darkness into light, your deadness into life, your bondage into liberty, and your weakness into strength. Fourth, you must set your hands to the work. It is in vain to expect that God should help you if you will not help yourselves. You must use your hands as well as your tongues. Idle beggars must be whipped. He that will not work must not eat. Remember what I have said. You have a life in you if you are Christ, and as you have a life, so there is a never-failing presence of the Spirit to attend that power which you have. Therefore, if you put yourselves to doing what you are able, and as far as your power extends, God will draw near to you. It is true that that which you lack is out of your reach. You are not able to make crooked things to become straight or lay those swelling mountains of corruption level, but yet you must set to the work. Joshua could not cast down the walls of Jericho by sounding the ram's horns unless he set upon the work. And when the Midianites fall, there must be both the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Judges 7 verse 18. The father holds an apple to the child, but the child cannot reach it. His short arm must be put forth, and then the father, whose arm is long enough, will extend it to him. So you must be doing. Before I come to show what is to be done, it will be useful to convince you that regenerate men have the power to do something of themselves. I'll say that again. Regenerate men have the power to do something of themselves. For off oftentimes men, misunderstanding the state of regeneration, do either excuse their negligence by pretended inability or lie down discouraged as having no power in their hands at all. How often do they complain and sigh in vain? Alas, I am nothing of myself unless God gives me heart and strength. What can I do? I can do nothing. To these, I would answer that these conclusions are ill drawn from a true principle, which is this, that all is by God, for by nature we are dead. But it is ill urged in this case, for the regenerate have a power to do good because they are living, and all life has a power to act. Otherwise, there would be no particular difference between a man who is regenerate and one who is unregenerate, if both are still dead and without strength. Furthermore, grace is a renewing of that image of God and holiness which we lost in Adam, Ephesians 4, verse 24, and this conveys with it a power to do what God requires. Therefore, as far as that image is repaired, there is power. If this were not so, we would not have as much of benefit by the second Adam as we had by the first. The first would have communicated his power to do good, and being corrupted, communicates power to sin. Therefore, much more by Christ have we a power to do good in our measure. Objection. It may be objected that it is said, without me you can do nothing, John 15, verse 5, so that it seems that we have not power in ourselves. Answer. The meaning is this. Unless you are implanted into me, you can do nothing. The word without me signifies separate from me or apart from me, and only intimates this, that until we are knit unto Christ, we are but dead and barren branches. And this is how Christ explains it himself. As the branch cannot bring forth fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can you, except ye abide in me. Verse 4. Objection. It is God that worketh both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Philippians 2, verse 13. Answer. This text proves what I say, that the saints have a power. It is true that it is from God, and therefore we should work out our salvation in humility, not boasting in ourselves, for all is received from God. More fully, God is said to work the will and the deed by giving habitual grace, which is a renewed frame of heart, and in executing and strengthening this grace. And both of these are ever afforded to the saints, yet the latter waxes and wanes according to his pleasure, so that in the worst of times, a Christian has a power to do good, although not alike at all times. And this power you must use and put forth yourselves as you are able, or else you cannot with reason expect his help. A ship has instruments in motion, though not an internal principle, and if the mariner would have help by the wind, he must loosen the cables and hoist his sails. So must you do, or else you may lie still. Now, this is that which you are to do. Number one, to stir up yourselves. God has promised to meet you and to reach out his hand to help you if you are not lacking to yourselves. It is certain that by the strength of his endeavors alone, a godly man cannot raise up his soul or recover his loss. Though he should lay mountain upon mountain and pile endeavor upon endeavor, yet he could not reach that life which he seeks. The strength of all our endeavors is the grace and promise of God. But as endeavors without God cannot, so God without endeavors will not. Therefore, labor to quicken yourselves, that is, to work upon your heart by your understandings. As the striking of the flint and steel together begets fire, So the meeting of these two faculties, which have an internal life in them, do quicken the soul. God has made the understanding the guide and treasure of the soul, and upon this altar lies the fire of God. If these coals are stoked up and cast upon the heart, they will warm, melt, purge, and quicken it. There are two things in a renewed mind. Letter A, a treasure of habitual knowledge. This is the ark of God in which the tablets of the law are kept. The mystery of the gospel is engraved upon it. In this way, the mind is the head to the body, which gives sense and motion to all the members. Spiritual truths are like the spirits in the head for the quickening of the soul. Letter B. There is a power to use and improve these truths. This is done by meditation and application, which awaken and provoke the will. As a man has power to counsel and persuade another, so also may he reason with himself using this discursive faculty. We see David pleading with himself in this manner. Well, sometimes he chides himself. Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted within me? Psalm 42, verse 5. At other times, he excites himself to duty. Praise the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Praise his holy name. Psalm 103, verse 1. At still other times, he comforts himself in God. Return to thy rest, O my soul, for God hath dealt bountifully with thee. Psalm 116, verse 7. In this way, it was a usual thing for him to talk within himself, or to talk with himself, for the mind has a language as well as the body. My reins teach me in the night season. Psalm 16, verse 7. I believe David means by reins the brain. I'll continue. David found so much good in this that he puts all upon it. Commune with your hearts upon your beds, and be still. Psalm 4, verse 4. Bring out those truths which are laid up in you, and sharpen yourself with them. God has fitted you with faculties and powers to do this. You have an apprehensive faculty to gather in truths and notions, a retentive faculty to lay them up, and a recollective faculty to bring them out again. You not only have the power of intelligence, but also of reminiscence, so that you may call to mind and ponder things known, and call them out of the cells in which they lie, so that they might revive the heart. The understanding is to the heart as the breast is to the child, or as the stomach is to the body. All is fed by it. And again, I'll note that this stuff only applies to those who are already regenerated. This does not apply to the ungodly. These faculties and powers do not lie within those who are not saved. This strictly refers to those who have been regenerated by the Holy Spirit, those who have been called by the Father and given to Christ and received salvation of Christ. And then after receiving Christ, being regenerated unto life by the Holy Spirit, only then do you have all these things. Okay, without them, none of this even applies to you. None of what I'm reading even applies to you. Okay, so understand that. Okay, I will continue. Therefore, set upon your hearts with quickening thoughts, for as rubbing and chafing the hands or other parts with hot oils is a means to recover them when they are benumbed, so the plying of the heart with stirring thoughts and reinforcing arguments is a means to revive it. Among all thoughts, there are none more prevalent than those of sins past, of heaven, hell, eternity, love for God, and the death of Christ. These are strong cordials to cheer up the spirits. To help you in the work of dealing with your hearts, let me propound these rules. Letter A. Make every notion practical. Let the heart share with the understanding. Do not count yourselves better for 1,000 notions unless there's some heat in them. Mind your hearts and strive to gain by all things. If you read, hear, or discourse, let your aim and desire be to better your hearts. Letter B. Be frequent in thoughts, for mindless men are lifeless. Letter C. Be ponderous, for slight thoughts are weak in working. Letter D. Pitch upon things which most concern you. All are good, but some are more seasonable. Letter E. Observe the temperament of your heart, and so apply what is best suited to it. All thoughts do not have the same efficacy in all men. The constitution of men's souls differ. Learn to know your temperament. Letter F. When thoughts begin to take hold, work diligently with them. Keep the fire burning, and do not let it go out for lack of blowing. Letter G. Arm your thoughts with prayer. Beseech God to be in them. Thus, then, employ your minds. This is God's way. He will keep the method which he has set. God has appointed the mind to this office, and he will not fail to use it. Kings do all by their officers. God does not come into the inward temple except by this gate. All his workings upon the heart are in a rational way, which is suitable to the state of the creature. He deals with the heart by the mind, and upon the whole man by the heart, as the first pipe takes in water for itself and for all the rest. Whatever is in the cistern of the heart is conveyed by the mind. The heart is the spring in the pocket watch of your souls. Wind it up, and all the wheels will move. Number 2. Attend the ordinances. I will say no more of this, having met with it before. Number 3. Take the help of the saints. Crave their counsel and prayers. Use their company, for they are living, and they will impart their life. They will be helpful to the feeble. They have a spirit of compassion to comfort the necessitous. Woe be to him that is alone. If he fall, who shall raise him up? Ecclesiastes 4, verse 10. It may be that your forsaking of the assembly of these has brought you into this withering state. God has appointed the saints unto fellowship, and when they knit not themselves together, but carelessly out of pride, vain fears, envy, or any other ungodly principle, hang off from each other. They shall not prosper. Number 4. Do your first works. This is the counsel of Christ to a backsliding church, Revelation 2, verse 5. Do your first works for quantity. Do as much as you did before. You see how abatement has impoverished you. Therefore, work harder to make yourselves or to make up yourselves again. And as much as you are able, do them also for quality, as you did before. Remember from whence you are fallen, and call to mind with what fear, reverence, diligence, intention of spirit, and tenderness you were accustomed to do everything. So do again. Objection. Alas, I cannot. This is my misery. If I could do as I have done, I could rejoice. Answer number 1. You may do more than you do. Answer number 2. See if the fault lies not more in the defect of will than of power, and stir up yourselves. If you were more willing, things would be easier. Answer number 3. The more you strive, the more you will gain. The root of discouragement is unbelief. When God bids you repent, he knows how little your strength is and how hard your hearts are. And so when he bids you pray, he knows what your infirmities are, both of immaturity and deficiency of grace, and those of sickness and declining from him. His intent is not that you should work these out alone, but he calls upon you to put your strength and will joined with you to go hand in hand alongside you. I'll read that last part again. His intent is not that you should work these out alone, but he calls upon you to put to your strength and will join with you to go hand in hand alongside you. Therefore, awaken yourselves and be encouraged, for if you are doing, he will work with you. in you and for you so that you may recover yourselves again. And what are all your sorrows and labors compared to this recompense? If God will return again, you will think all labor and pains were well bestowed. Oh, how sweet will life be after such a time of deadness! How sweet will an established faith and clear understanding be after such mists of darkness and unbelief! I'm actually going to intercede right here for a second. I can attest to that myself. Okay, and I'm going to do a bit of a commentary after the end of this book and give sort of a testimony as I was in this position from May of 2012 to May of 2014, where I was in this very place for which I'm reading this book that was written by Joseph Simmons to you, whoever you are who are listening. I've been there, and I'm telling you right now that this is all true. Okay, but let me continue. How sweet will liberty be after so long a time of cruel servitude? How sweet will victory and rest be after so long and so bloody a war? Now you dwell in the dust, surrounded by hellish lusts and unclean spirits, but you shall be filled with the Spirit of Christ and shall converse with God. It will be a sweet time when all things shall become new. The ordinances will be as the green pastures in which your souls shall feed and delight themselves. Your diseases shall be turned into health. You shall renew your strength as the eagles. All this will come to you when Christ comes to sit on his former throne to rule you with the scepter of his grace. And I pray to God that all that have been deserted may seek him and find him. This shall suffice for the first sort of spiritual desertions. Now follows another sort, if I may so call it, desertions which are in appearance only. Chapter 30, of desertions in appearance only, with causes of mistakes in this case. Having finished the first sort of desertions, or God's withdrawing of the quickening influence of his Spirit, which is when a man truly is deserted, I come now to those desertions which seem such, but are not. A godly man sometimes may draw sad conclusions against himself and conceive that God has departed from him when it is not so. This mistake proceeds from such causes as these. Number one, fearfulness. This abounds in some more than others. The matter is weighty, and in such cases, man is apt to fear. One who is upon a tower, though the tower is sturdy and he is sure-footed, yet when he looks down, he is appalled at the dreadfulness of the precipice and counts himself in danger. This fear is increased in men because they know that they may sink into such depths, and they see that many have fallen. In a time of pestilence and great mortality, fear takes hold of some so strongly that they sometimes think that they are stricken, and that they are going to the house of silence and darkness, when in fact they are in a healthful state. So sometimes do men think in this case. The tempers of some spirits are such that they are apt to fear. There are dusky clouds of melancholy darkening their reason, and they think with that melancholy King Nebuchadnezzar that of all men they have become beasts, and so are ready to dispose themselves from that princely state in which they lived, to feed with the oxen. And to all this there is a working of the Prince of Darkness, who labors to hide the light and to increase the darkness and sadness of the fearful soul. And this fear, being raised, creates dismal visions and apprehensions, so that a man seems to himself to be metamorphosed, and he thinks he is one who has been cast out from God, when yet his case is good. Number two, a mistake in the cause of a present deadness. When men are clogged with indisposedness and ill-disposedness, they sometimes attribute this to God's withdrawing of himself, when indeed it is the fruit of their own carelessness, slothfulness, and untowardness. They do not take pains with themselves, but they allow their hearts to die and to be depraved, and then cry out that God has forsaken them. There is an aptness in men to charge God, but awaken yourselves, lest God withdraw indeed. Number three, in misjudging themselves. They think worse of themselves than they are, and there are sundry things which occasion them to make this mistake. Letter A. Spiritual poverty. A poor man is apt to complain, and a humble man is apt to think mean thoughts of himself. There is one that maketh himself rich, yet hath nothing, and there is one that maketh himself poor, yet has great riches. Proverbs 13, verse 7. Some men's hearts are high when their worth is low. The emptiest bars stand highest, but the richest mines lie low. Mine, not mind. Mine isn't like gold mine. A humble Christian is a rich treasure, yet he thinks he is worth but little. But I must tell you, all is not gold that glistens. All in a godly man that seems to be grace is not. There is a bastard humility as well as a genuine humility. True humility is judicious, though it thinks meanly of itself, yet justly. It does not judge against truth. False humility is distempered and errs in judgment. It is a melancholy distemper and the habit of humility which can see nothing but ill sights and can see no good. When it looks this way, it cannot see the forest for the trees. It is ever in subtraction in its account of its real worth and matters of encouragement, and always beyond measure in multiplication and addition of its faults, deficits, and all matters of discouragement. Ask him how he is, and he will tell you he is a beggar, a miserable man who is bankrupt, full of sin, and empty of God, seeing nothing, having nothing, tasting nothing, and doing nothing. Yea, he will tell you, but who can believe him that knows his rich worth, that he is worse than nothing? Letter B. Hungering and thirsting after more grace. This is the sweet companion of humility, but it has this property to lead the soul still outward. It is so serious in seeking what it does not have that it minds not what it does have. A covetous man is always poor because he is always wanting. He forgets what is behind and is still pressing toward that which is before. It is the fault of such as are filled with strong desires after God that they often forget what they have already received. Pride always feeds on what it has, but humility sees best what it does not have. But you should remember that strong desires after God are strong evidences of his presence. Other things are first desired and then attained, but spiritual things are first attained, then desired. Without these desires, the heart would rest without God, and as it cannot be without some chief good, so it would seek it out of God. But when it is wheeled about with strong biases towards God, doubtless God is there. Number 3. Much love. This is closely related to the two former things, and is an occasion sometimes of sad thoughts in the heart. Love has qualities which expose the heart to trouble. Letter A. It is jealous, ever fearful lest it should lose the happiness which it now has in enjoying God. This jealousy, sometimes rising high, inclines a man to think that God is gone. It is the nature of a fearful heart to fall from care to fear, from fear to jealousies, and from jealous suspicions to sad conclusions. The mother, out of vehement affection for her child, if he is out of her sight, first takes care, then is filled with fears and sad conjectures, and at last cries out, "Where is my child?" Letter B. Love is liberal and is never satisfied. It would still do better and be better, and the more it is, the less it seems so to itself, and thus it is continually enlarged in dispositions and resolutions to do good. As it knows it cannot do enough, so it is apt to think it does almost nothing. Hence, many complaints arise that love is not with them as in former days. That which they did before seemed much at the time because love was not much, but now all seems little because love is greater. But you should consider that God is much there where he works much, and that this flame of love is blown up by him, for God is love, 1 John 4, 16a. That is to say, the fountain and author of love, and as love is eminently and infinitely in him, so it flows from him. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. That's verse 16b. Chapter 31. Men may also mistake themselves as deserted by judging with false rules. Judging by false rules is a cause of mistakes when a man seems to himself to be deserted by God, but indeed is not. For instance, false rule number one. Men judge that they are deserted and fear they are in a state of decline because they conceive that they have less quickness and vivacity than they have had previously. I confess this is an ominous sign, yet it is possible that there is no just cause for such sad conclusions, and to satisfy such, let me propound four things. Number one, distinguish between God's working in gifts and his working in graces. God is sometimes pleased to carry up the gifts of men very high, while their spiritual lives do not have proportionate elevation. We see he is much this way, sometimes in men that are not good. Gifts are given to the members for the body and for others' sakes. Oftentimes he pours out great measures and bears them on with a full gale of assistance. And when the work is done to which those gifts serve, then God may withdraw. I do not doubt that many faithful preachers may find a weakness and dullness in their gifts to be a sign of judgment upon the people. For the deafness of the hearers, God smites the messengers dumb, and so, in sundry cases, it might happen. It is said that Christ could do no mighty works in his own country, Mark 6, verse 5. His hands were, as it were, tied and bound. His power was suspended because of their unbelief, and where God had some great work to do, he opened the hearts of the apostles and much enlarged their spirits. Therefore, wisely distinguish between gifts and graces. Though you are not able to do as you have done before, yet see into the frame and disposition of your heart toward God, for the latter may continue when the former fades. It may be that you have not had the occasion to use these gifts as you have had before, and unless they are used, they inevitably grow dull. The most expert musician, by disuse, may lose his skill, but note here that where there is occasion for use of gifts, and they are not stirred up, but permitted by idleness and carelessness to be quenched, this is a sin against the Spirit, and breeds a damp not only upon gifts, but upon grace. Number two, God may and does sometimes give more full assistance to the graces of his people than he will perpetually continue, and the abatement of this is no just cause for concluding that God has forsaken them. Letter A. In times of seeking him and of mediate conversation and prayer and meditation and the like, there is a fuller taste of him than at other times. A godly man enjoys God in all things, but especially in duties of piety. There is an evident reason why a man has more of God than because grace is now acting and feeding upon God. Duties are the meals of a Christian, and other actions are his work. He comes in duties to receive strength, while in other things he uses it. The body gets strength and refreshment by eating, draws it out in working, and then comes to repair it again by eating. Times of immediate approach to God are meeting times. There is a mutual visit between God and the soul, and this is the proper end of these things, that God and the soul may meet together. It would be a happy thing if those impressions which the soul receives at such times were abiding, but such is our condition here, that we must hunger and eat, and when we are filled, we shall hunger again. Heaven is the place of constant life where there is a continual feast, but here we cannot have it so. The mind is but finite, and since it is necessary to converse with other things besides God, it cannot be expected that it should be so constantly filled with him. A man enjoys God as much as he seriously minds him. Therefore, those that neglect duties or slightly perform them must by necessity lose much of God. But it is not to be expected to carry such a spirit in other employments and activities as one has when conversing with God, though the more a man has in his duties, the better he will be in all things, and the fitter to meet God in all his seasons. Letter B. In times of great necessity. When temptations, afflictions, and dangers are many and great, God typically affords more of himself than at other times. A father, when his child comes to a ditch or deep way which he cannot pass, takes up the child into his arms, but when he has gotten over it, he sets him down again. So God, in such hard cases, ministers more abundant aid when he does not continue always. Hence we see that even the weakest of the flock become lions, and those that seem to be but little prove like mighty champions, victoriously conquering in difficulties, and treading underfoot the glory and terror of the world, yea, the fears of death itself. These, by transcendent nobility and a high courage of spirit, which are so far above their ordinary pitch, do declare that there is another power with them than their own, which makes them so gloriously to exceed not only others, but themselves also. As the Spirit came upon Samson when the Philistines came upon him, so it is in this case. But God is not always so at so much cost, when the necessities of his people are less, than he gives them their accustomed pension. When Israel was in the desert, a place barren of comforts, but full of troubles and emergencies, God, by his mighty power, did work greater things for them than he ever did afterward, yet he was still their God. At the first coming of the gospel, the way being new, and so subject to the cavils and persecutions which Christ knew the world would raise against it, he poured out more of his Spirit, and wrought with more glorious power than in succeeding ages. Yet the promise of Christ stands firm. Lo, I am with you to the end of the world, Matthew 28, verse 20. I'll interject here. It sounds here that Joseph Simmons was a cessationist. I may be stepping out a little bit on that, but that's what I gather from that writing. Anyway, number three. There may be more quickness and vivacity of spirit at and around the time of conversion than afterwards. Hence, many conclude that they are sinfully abated and that they have fallen from their first love. But although I do not doubt that this is indeed a just complaint in many, yet I believe that some do charge themselves without just cause. Note, therefore, that by two things there may be a greater flush of affection at that time than in the time afterward. Letter A. A newness of the condition. Naturally, new things affect much. The suddenness of the change, to be translated from blackness of darkness into marvelous light, does greatly affect them. In this case, distinguish between solid affection and fleeting passion. The soul of a new convert is put into a kind of astonishment to see such a strange and sudden metamorphosis. It is as if he had become another man, and the whole world were turned upside down, so that heaven stands where earth did, and the earth in heaven's place. High things are made low, and low things are set on high. These things will put the soul into amazement, but much of this will wear off. Suppose a man is going to his execution and is great in heaviness and fears, but on the way his pardon, along with the promise of the prince's favor, is brought to him. Methinks I see his heart leaping, his spirit dancing, and the man filled with abundant joy. But mark him, and in process of time you will see much of this vanishing, even though his life is still as dear as ever. Or suppose two persons married, sweetly conjoined in dear affections, are exposed to many dangers and difficulties. What a flush of joy is mutually expressed afterward! What violence of affection, happily enjoying each other's desired company! But in time much of this ceases, even though true love still remains. Do not count as grace everything which is working at the time of the first conjunction of Christ and the soul. There is much passion in it, albeit such as is holy and good. But as it was stirred up on special occasion, so as the occasion ceases, it may cease, and yet the case may still be good. The Jews were as those that dreamed when they were first delivered, but that dream did not always last. The lame man, when he was first healed, was seen walking, leaping, and praising God, Acts 3, verse 8. But though he was always glad of his recovery, yet he did not always leap and dance. Letter B. God does more at the first conversion for his people. He gives more assistance, for now a man is entering upon a new way, a way of difficulties, and all the power of hell comes out, as Pharaoh, to reclaim its escaped captives. Therefore, God covers them with his hand and fills them with strength to grapple with this legion and to break through these difficulties. God often pours in much comfort at that time. When the prodigal returned, his father made him very welcome and called to his servant, "Bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." Luke 15, verses 23 through 24. Hence was more than of necessity, not only shoes, but a ring, not only clothes, but the best robes. Here is feasting, joy, and cheer. This son was as welcome afterwards, yet had not this entertainment every day. It may be that some of the comfortable presence of God which he then affords, and some of that abundant joy, may cease, because it was given upon a special occasion. And yet no just cause is given to raise such sad thoughts that God has forsaken you. Number 4. There may be less activity, not from change of the spirit, but of nature. The body may be more feeble. Sickness or age may clip the wings of activity and take off much of a man's former vigor. The body is the instrument of the soul, and as he that rides upon a weak and tired horse cannot ride post, so when the oil of natural life and vigor begins to wane, it cannot burn as clearly as it had in former days. We see in sickness, when the natural strength is decayed, how the loss of spirits degrades them from that high luster, whereas they were admired in the time of health. It may be a caveat and warning to careless and dilatory spirits to be better husbands in opportunity, and while their blood is full in their veins and their arteries are rich in spirits, to take hold of time by this golden forelock and to make their voyage while they have full tide and wind, lest when death creeps on and by diseases has dismounted them from their vigor, they find darkness and sleepiness to bind them in chains. But for those whose feet did run in the ways of God, and who were as the winged bird when youthfulness and vigor was in them, their breasts flowing with milk and their bones full of marrow, though now, their nature being decayed, they seem less, yet their case is safe and good. Alas, when the keepers of the house tremble, and the strong men bow themselves, and those that look out of the windows are darkened, and when their almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper is a burden, and desire faileth, when the silver cord is loosing, and the golden bowl breaking, Ecclesiastes 12, verses 3 through 6. When nature is brought to this low state, how can it be that there should be that liveliness of soul which was there before?